pocket to the shores of Orange Beach and all points in between. An insider's perspective on Alabama politics. It's the Jeff Poor Show.
I don't think Hank done it this way.
Welcome back to the Jeff Poor Show. Hour number three for you here on this Friday morning. So good to be with you. Thank you for tuning in. Coming up at the bottom of the hour, State Senator Chris Elliott joins us, so we'll catch up with him. Going to be a regular Friday guest. So lots of reasons to look forward to the Jeff Poor Show, particularly on Friday. You get State Senator Chris Elliott. Don't mind those crunching of pistachio shells in the background. It is my, a mentor of sorts holding my hand through this first week. This last hour of this first week has been a very traumatizing experience going to a new station. Always with the fear of potential termination just looming right at you. But we're in the home stretch. Very excited about that. 251-343-0106. That's 251-343-0106. Text, phone, whatever. Or hit me up on Twitter, twitter.com/Jeff_poor. So we're going to get to this started talking about this in the last segment a little bit. Nancy Pelosi out there talking about how she doesn't think the vice presidential candidate matters. I think it does. I think it matters in the scheme of if you have a candidate that's damaged, and I would say not damaged, but just there's just no enthusiasm for. And what did we see with how hard was it to get excited about Bob Dole? Even though he had the resume of being a World War II veteran, he just didn't inspire that. You know the way Obama did, something new, hope and change, something like that. So, and same with John McCain, even though he was a Vietnam War veteran. It didn't inspire a lot of enthusiasm. You bring in Sarah Palin, I'm telling you, people just got excited overnight. I worked in the conservative movement at the time in Washington, D.C., and my colleagues, particularly the female colleagues, were excited about that possibility, that she was a family woman. She understood their plight. She was relatable. And that turned out to be a big deal for McCain because he started closing that gap on Obama. But remember, it all went south when the financial crisis unfolded. So Pelosi's wrong about that. But I think in this circumstance, will people get excited about who Joe Biden picks? Joe Biden himself, is he that exciting? So we'll have to wait and see. I don't think they'll throw a Hail Mary. I think we pretty much know the finalist. It won't come out of left field like it did in 2008. Let's take a quick phone call here. Let's hear from Chris, who wants to weigh in on Doug Jones. Chris, what's on your mind?
Hey, Jeff. Welcome to Mobile.
Thank you, sir.
And I was listening on your last session and talking with Steve. And Doug Jones, when he cast his vote for impeaching President Trump, I had sent him a letter probably a week or so before the initial vote. And his indications were that the evidence was overwhelming, and that is the reason that he voted to impeach. And then with Brett Kavanaugh, I sent him a letter saying, hey, here's your opportunity to side with the people of Alabama. And obviously, this guy did nothing wrong. And he came back saying, well, he just didn't have enough evidence to prove he was innocent.
Right.
And with that, you know, if that's the way Doug's going to be, he's a hard-leaning left, and he's not going to do anything Alabama wants. He's going to do what the party wants.
Hey, thanks for the call, Chris. I don't disagree. I thought Doug Jones, on day one, they reached out to me, the Breitbart guy, the right-leaning guy, almost immediately, and I thought, well, maybe they are going to look at trying a more moderate approach. Maybe they are going to run. Doug Jones is going to be in the mold of a Joe Manchin or somebody like a Zell Miller. You know, these Democrats, these Southern Democrats of the past, well, they're almost populist. They're pro labor. They are, you know, the conservative church going pro gun, pro Second Amendment, but on policy, they're very progressive, let's say. They're not quite pro-business, or they're not pro-business at all. They're something totally different. turned out not to be that way. Turned out to be that way at all. So it's just fascinating to watch. And I my theory is, just talking to Steve Flowers last hour, Jones knew he was going to have a very tough reelection bid, and he knew he needed to raise some money to be competitive. So that being said, I thought, well, he knows he's got to raise money. He's not going to upset an out-of-state base. Therefore, he's going to have to vote against Kavanaugh, who he said he lacked the judicial temperament to sit on the high court, I believe. And then, obviously, with the impeachment thing, just we kind of knew what that was. I think everybody, even Nancy Pelosi, knew what that was. But he went with impeachment. That might have been that's going to be very tough to overcome for Senator Jones. One thing you need to talk about real quick, Larry Kudlow, President's economic advisor. We've been hearing some hints at this, that if Congress allows some of these benefits from this last stimulus, this CARES Act, to lapse, they were going to go at it on their own. The administration was, with some executive orders. And the one that's very fascinating to me, with Larry Kudlow, who's the kind of the spokesman of the economic policy for the White House, they got to go executive order. And a part of that executive order, perhaps, is using executive authority for a payroll tax cut. So I guess I don't know how this is going to work with payroll systems and all of that, but you're just not going to collect payroll taxes? How will that work? And dare I say, here's what will be interesting, though. If they go through with this and the Democrats say, we're going to sue you, you can't do that, you don't have the ability to do that, that's unconstitutional, what does the Trump administration respond to that? Why do Democrats not want you to have a payroll tax cut? Why do they want your money for themselves? See how this game is played? It's not quite three-dimensional chess, but maybe it's a step or two ahead on the chessboard. But you're putting Democrats in a position to have to... They're not going to like this. They don't like the payroll tax cut idea. They never have. They've offered some hemming and hawing and reasons why that doesn't really work. But they much prefer sending out checks. It's funny because Trump did something during that last episode with the CARES Act that really upset them. He got his name printed on the checks. What do you think that was all about? That really upset a lot of Democrats. But going at it on their own, I would agree with Democrats. Trump doesn't have the constitutional authority to do this. But they're going to try. They got to make a legal argument. What would the legal argument be? Congress makes laws, we execute them, but we choose not to execute this? I don't know. Fiscal policy, the purse strings are controlled by the legislative branch. We learned that in civics class. How do you do this through executive action? And I would suspect if it were Obama in his pen and his phone, it would be widely heralded within the ranks of the news media. But we have all these disagreements. They come up and over and over and over and over again as it pertains to what executive authorities president has. One thing we've learned from the Trump administration, and if a Democrat is elected, eventually a Democrat will be elected, if not Joe Biden, somebody along the way will be in the White House with a D next to their name. I like to see Republicans challenge executive authority as aggressively as the Democrats and the loyal opposition has with Trump. Stuff that we knew the president had the authority to. There was legal precedent there for him to do such things. Restrict who could come into the country on travel bans. Even moving military assets around. Things of that nature. We knew that was all within the purview of the president of the United States. But now, Democrats are going to challenge it anyway. They want to gunk up the system. They want to slow this down. They don't want to make it easy. And there's plenty of people out there willing to do this. They go court shopping. They go to the Ninth Circuit. Democrats have mastered that system. It's time for Republicans to, whenever Republicans are out of power. But that's never been part of their DNA, never part of their playbook. And I guess the fear is that if Republicans got too aggressive, well, then you have a messaging strategy from Democrats that would be, why do Republicans want to stop us from doing all this good we're just trying to do for you? And for that reason, Republicans, they cower, they hide. It would take away from whatever good money the highly esteemed Senator Richard Shelby is trying to bring back to Alabama. That's why he doesn't fight these ideological fights. He is the chairman of the Appropriations Committee. And if he got bogged down in that stuff, that's for the Rand Pauls and Ted Cruz's out there. If he got bogged down in that stuff, well, do you think we'd be getting this this gift that we're going to dredge the harbor here, the Port of Mobile? Of course not. Well, I got more important things to fight. But I think from a voter's perspective, particularly from a Republican voter's perspective, and that's what, let's face it, that's what dominates things in Alabama. I think a lot of you guys would like to see Democrats or Republicans play by the Democrat rule book sometimes and think that things that are bad for the country that you disagree with, that they would take this on. But watch this payroll tax cut. That's what I think is going on here. They're going to force Democrats into a corner and make them say, we're taking you to court, get a federal judge and a liberal Obama appointee court to say, nope, you can't do that. Stop it right now, Trump administration, and you're going to have some district judge, a federal judge somewhere say, no, you can't do this. And Rachel Maddow will read the whole opinion and tell you why it's important. But all Republicans got to do is turn around on them. Why does the left want hardworking Americans not to have a tax cut? Why do they not want you to have more money to spend on your family? And we could disagree or agree about the merits of a payroll tax cut and whether or not that's a justifiable thing to do. I mean, there's all kinds of policy arguments to be had, whether or not it will benefit the economy, it will get things back up and running. But that's not the point. Just look at it from a purely political standpoint. Who does this benefit, Republicans or Democrats, particularly in a presidential election cycle? And does this move Trump up? Because now Trump can say, well, at least I'm doing something. It's those Democrats that won't let me do it. It's the do-nothing Democrats in Congress. I mean, that's very Truman-esque, I suppose. Truman, very unpopular president, and ran against Congress and was successful. Trump's not doing that. Trump is it's never been in his DNA to do that because, first of all, Congress is, it's either been all in Republicans' hands or split between the parties as it is now. But the other question you got to ask yourself, what is this going to do to all those congressional races down ballot from Trump? I think Trump has coattails. I think it would behoove Republicans to stick with Trump for this cycle. But is there any Republicans out there that are up in 2022 that are thinking, man, I don't want to run with that with Trump in the White House again? I know that's going to be a big Democrat year. It's a 7-year itch, as they say. When you get to the midterm and the second term, it's very difficult for the party in power in the White House. Wasn't so much difficult. 2010 was a more difficult cycle for Obama, but 2014 wasn't that great. They lost the Senate, the Democrats had. 2006 was a bloodbath. I remember it. It was just a bad, bad day, the midterms of 2006. 2022, if Trump's reelected, be very, very, very tough for Republicans. And I wonder if any members of Congress are thinking that. We've got to take a break. We will return. This is FM Talk 106.5.
Living on the road, my friend, was gonna keep you free and clean.
Welcome back to the Jeff Poehler Show on FM Talk 106.5. Happy Friday morning to you. Coming up Monday on the program, got a big show for you. We got Congressman Gary Palmer from Alabama's 6th Congressional District, represents the area around Birmingham. He's very big on the role of the federal government for expansion of transportation projects. So just recently heard him start talking about statewide projects, not just, you know, the usual Birmingham Fair, the Northern Belt Line and whatnot, but also he's, which would make me think maybe he's got an eye on statewide office, but important to have him on just to talk about transportation projects, particularly the I-10 bridge. I know we haven't talked about the I-10 bridge in my first week here. Haven't really gotten into that much. But Irvin Palmer's got some thoughts on it, the role of the federal government, you know, just kind of where we need to get on getting money from the feds on that and not a $20 toll or whatever the hell Governor Ivey was proposing back earlier in 2019. Also on the program, I'm reluctant to do this, but he is a former colleague, let's say, from WVNN in Huntsville, the one and only Dale Jackson wants to be on with us. We're going to talk to him.
You're fired.
About some state politics. Well, he would say that whenever I'd have you on my show there, Sean. Also, our usual Monday guest joins us in studio every Monday. State Representative Matt Simpson will be with us. That's Monday. So make sure you tune in for that. More about Pelosi. We're going to talk about Pelosi in the last segment, not really. Just kind of shrugging off the vice presidential pick. Not that big of a deal to her. Is anybody, some of you out there watch a lot of cable news, and it's not just Fox News, but some of you tune in regularly. Has anybody noticed Nancy Pelosi is on TV a lot these days? Well, I don't know what that's about. I've been trying to figure it out because she's not exactly a good face for Democrats on either side of it. She's not a good, warm, moderate, like, voice, a voice of moderation. Nor is she to the progressives out there, the far, far left, the people that see her as part of the problem, the AOCs, the Bernie Sanders, that crowd. She is just the institution of the rank and file of the Democratic Party. Let me tell you why Pelosi is Speaker of the House. It's not because she's some kind of great policy mind. She's not even that. She's okay at this. She can herd cats pretty well within her caucus. I mean, that's part of the job. But she's a pro at fundraising. She can fundraise, and she can help these vulnerable members in their districts raise money to be competitive. Or maybe they're not even that vulnerable. But she's able to... She's able to win them over that way and win their support. So she's on TV a lot. In some ways, she is the chief surrogate for the Biden campaign. It, if you find this strange, it's not the Democratic, presumptive Democratic presidential nominee that's doing 2-3 television appearances a day. It's the Speaker of the House is the chief surrogate for the Biden campaign right now. And we've never really seen this. I mean, look back at past speakers. Would Newt Gingrich have been a good surrogate for any of the last few Republicans, even though he ran for president? And he won one state, one South Carolina. That did not propel him to the nomination, by the way, like it did Joe Biden. Or John Boehner, as amusing as I find John Boehner to be, and he's fantastic just to talk to, probably not the quintessential voice of the Republican Party that you really want. You don't want him as the face, although the Obama administration tried. But has there ever been a speaker this active in presidential politics? She's on MSNBC a moment ago. She says Trump is projecting himself when he says Biden is against God and that Biden knows nothing about church. Whether that's true or not, why isn't Pelosi the one saying it? Is she the one that... She looks like she belongs in Madame Tussauds Wax Museum. People see her. Do they think, man, I want to go out and vote Democrat? I don't think that is the... I don't think that's the thought process there. But she gets a lot of airtime. And understanding it, does she not think... Is there, out of all the Democrats in the House Democrat Caucus, look at the people you see on TV a lot. Adam Schiff, there's a charismatic individual right there, if I ever saw one. Eric Swalwell. The people that are on TV a lot, they're not... is it just a bubble thing where they think, well, this is the brand we want to portray? I think if I'm Nancy Pelosi, I am trying to curry favor with AOC and get her to be the face. But you just don't know what she's going to say. Likewise, in the Senate, Chuck Schumer on television quite a bit as well. Leadership in the, among Democrats, congressional Democrats, are they perhaps looking at bettering their chances? They're not as focused on the presidential race, but winning Congress back or winning the Senate back. And we don't talk about the House a whole heck of a lot. Is the House up for grabs? Could Republicans win the House of Representatives if things go right? That is not out of the realm of possibilities, guys, because the House of Representatives, it's a narrow, narrow margin. You only need to flip 16, 17 seats and you get control of the House back. That could happen. It's just the wind could got to be blowing right, at least right now on August 7th, 2020. Who knows what will happen now between now and Election Day. But as of right now, if things are going good for Trump, then maybe they got a shot at the House because Trump will have coattails. Let's take a time out. We will return. This is the Jeff Porch Show at FM Talk 106.5.
Say a thing. We fired our guns and the British kept a-coming. There wasn't as many as there was a while ago. We fired once more and they began to run in. On down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico.
I hear Richard Best picking on that red guitar. So get around. Now get around, chill and be down. Well, just get down, chill and get loud. Well, you can be loud, yeah, and be proud. And you can be proud, yeah, and I'll be proud too. Well, well, because South's gonna do it again and again.
Welcome back to the Jeff Porch Show on FM Talk 106.5. Happy Friday morning to you as we approach the weekend. That'll be a good one. Hopefully everyone out there has good weekend plans. I certainly do. I'm just breathing sighs of relief that I still have employment status here at FM Talk 106.5. That's always a good thing. Real quick, coming up Monday, we'll have Congressman Gary Palmer joining us from FM Talk from WVNN. We'll have Dale Jackson, morning host there, and State Representative Matt Simpson. So make sure you tune in on Monday. That'll be a great show. May add another guest or two to the roster. Who knows what could happen. Joining us now, our usual Friday guest. He represents you folks in Baldwin County. State Senator Chris Elliott joins us on the line. Senator, how are you today?
I'm doing great. Glad to have you down here in South Alabama.
Yeah, so I'm glad you feel that way because I was worried the reception down here, which way that could go. You never know these days.
We're happy to have you.
Senator, let's get right into it. COVID-19, how are things going over there? Last time we talked, things were kind of coming back, but just give us a progress report.
You know, I think things are really going about as well as can be expected. The social distancing is taking place. The big concern, you know, now is as we transition from a summertime, business type of season for our beaches and our tourists back into school, and that's going to be a challenge. That's going to be something that that I think we are still unsure of statewide and here in South Alabama as well. We're going to have to see how it goes. I am concerned myself. You know, two kids myself, both of whom are going to be starting school next week. We've talked about measures to try to stay safe, but also to try to get back to normal and see if we can make it through this pandemic as unscathed as possible.
I mean, it seems to me, particularly with the schools, it's just kind of let's see how this goes. While the discussion is, well, we got to do this or we got to do that, but probably the best approach is if we learn anything from the shutdown experience, it's a little bit of trial and error.
It is, and I think that's a fair way to characterize the response nationally from a statewide level and locally as well. You know, we didn't understand this virus going in. It was new. We didn't understand transmission rates, hospitalization rates, mortality rates. And I think it's really poked holes in our government's system from a response standpoint. And also, you know, brought out some pretty serious constitutional issues that will need to be addressed later on down the road.
Yeah, those constitutional issues can it seems to me, based on all of this, and then there's a lot of your colleagues in the legislature, or whenever you guys finally do reconvene, be it in a special session, all that doesn't look very likely when you reconvene in the in 2021, going to be looking at some kind of overhaul of how all of this works, because we never know when one of these pandemics might come along again.
Well, we don't, and look, there's two different things, you know, conversations to have. One is, did we do the right thing? And I think in some cases, yes, and in some cases, absolutely not. And then, you know, the other question is that authority and power vested in the right place, and should it be there? Do we need to clarify laws that are 100 years old that deal with emergency powers, you know? And I think the answer to that is absolutely. You know, Senator Whatley, it's his birthday today, by the way, Senator Whatley, had a bill last session that did not matriculate, but I expect will in the next session, that really overhauls the powers and authorities, not only of the state health officer, but of the governor under the Emergency Powers Act. And we need to look at that and see if we can figure out a way to get some better consensus from and input from the legislature if we're going to have these prolonged states of emergency.
I mean, it seems like a good approach is kind of like when the president uses military force, and he has a window of time before he has to go seek authorization from the Congress. In these circumstances, whether they're just having these indefinite shutdowns, or, you know, they have arbitrary dates assigned to them, but the governor could say, well, we're going to extend this, that there ought to be some sort of legislative oversight or some component like that.
Absolutely, and that's what that proposed legislation, you know, ponders, and I think this is really for folks that are concerned about the constitutionality of and how these executive orders are working and for how long they may be in effect. It is very concerning, and it has gotten folks' attention, and I think will definitely be something that the legislature looks at when we reconvene.
Do you have any ideas just how much of that is, just how much of a role the legislature should have? Because there would be, there'd be pushback against it that you don't want to tie the hands of the governor or the executive too much, because you want them to have the ability to respond in an emergency situation. Just how much executive power, because traditionally that office, at least compared to other offices, other governor's offices around the country, isn't as strong. Just where is that right balance?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, we had that question on the federal level as well. You were talking about that before your break, and it's one that I think in a republic like ours, we need to continue to talk about separation of powers and where the good balance is. But I think that what we've seen in this particular instance with this pandemic is a governor that is essentially saying that her emergency powers are unending and that they can continue indefinitely without any oversight from the legislature or any other body. And that is, I think, a red flag when you look at separation of powers and you look at checks and balances. And if that is the assertion, and it seems to be in the last executive order, then that is justifiably concerned. And again, that's not necessarily discussing the merits of any decisions and that have been made under those executive powers, those emergency powers, but rather the fact that they are like they are and they exist as they are, and that they could be indefinite, that is concerning. But you do point out, we do want the executive to have the ability to respond immediately to emergencies. Of course, down here on the coast, we have weather events. We don't like to say the H word this time of year, and we try not to say it, but we do have weather events that sometimes require swift and immediate action. But those are not events that should last for months and months and months. And that seems to be what's happening here, and is a good reason to probably revisit the enabling and underlying statute that allows for those emergency powers.
Now, Senator, your history with Governor Ivey is well documented. I guess I might know the answer to this part of the question. Are you in conversations? Are they keeping you up to date? But do you get the sense that what the governor's office decision making, are they at least keeping the leadership and the respected chambers of the Alabama legislature kind of updated on their decision making process? Are you hearing anything like that?
you know, I'll let them speak for themselves, but I can tell you that, no, I don't necessarily get that feel from you know, the leadership. I think that this administration is very much of a go-it-alone. I think we saw that in the last legislative session with the debate over the CARES Act money. Very contentious, you know, and really didn't need to be. But and I will say, I think I'm a little bit surprised by that, because there was such a good working relationship with the legislature early on, when we, for instance, we're talking about infrastructure funding. That worked fairly well with the leadership. There was a lot of conversation and discussions back and forth, and ended up being successful, at least from the governor's standpoint. But that relationship has certainly soured. I think there were some efforts to try to put it back together, but it's been a marked shift between what happened at the beginning of the quadrennium and where we are now.
Yeah, you're referring to the CARES Act money, and then we had this, you know, this bombshell story that the legislature wanted to take money for the long-suffering people from COVID-19 to use on a new state house. It embarrassed the legislature. But what it did, it seemingly embarrassed the Senate more than it embarrassed the House. But then in that 11th hour, right before y'all gaveled out, the House and the governor come up with they broker an agreement, vote on it. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, you were the only no vote on that budget. Is that situation getting better, or are we just kind of where we were and we're hoping for the best when you pick up in 2021?
I think it's the latter of the two. I think it is a hope for the best. I know there have been some limited conversations, you know, between the Senate leadership and the governor's office, but I still think there are some very sore feelings over that. Now, we're all bigger than that, and we've got a state to run, and we'll get over it and move on. But those types of power plays for the sake of power, and embarrassing an entire, you know, legislative body on purpose and for a political reason, are not going to bode well for a future working relationship. And they really ought to have known that. I mean, at this level of you know, operation for politicos, you know, you got to know, you got to still govern it with these folks at the end of the day, and treating them like the administration treated the legislature is just does not bode well. And we'll have to see how that plays out for the rest of this administration.
Well, and I think the one big item on the list, the governor, well, there's really just two, and if you listen to her inauguration speech, it was infrastructure, which that was accomplished almost immediately with the Rebuild Alabama Act, but prisons, the prison question. The governor's going to go at it on her own. It looks like the Contract Review Committee has approved some money to be spent and headed in that direction. Where do you think we are on the prison question? And do you think the way the governor is handling this, particularly with the DOJ kind of looking down at Alabama, at the ADOC, that this is getting in headed to a satisfactory place?
Well, you know, this is another great example of this administration essentially going it alone, right? And they have even justified that. They've essentially admitted that they are, and they have used as justification the fact that Governor Bentley was unable to get the legislature to move forward on some prison construction plans during his administration. And they said, well, the legislature had a chance to fix this, and they didn't. Well, that's a fair characterization of that effort that was made by a previous governor and a previous legislature. But one-third of the legislature that sits in both the House and Senate, including myself, was not there when that effort took place. And this governor wasn't in the chair when that last effort took place. So simply using past failures as a justification to not go through the legislative appropriation process on this, I think is a bad idea. And I think that at the end of the day, it's going to be very costly for the people of Alabama, much more so than is necessary, to privatize the construction through some sort of public-private partnership and then leaseback program, it's going to be much more expensive than a simple bond issuance at historically low bond rates for the state to go out and construct and maintain the prisons that we need in order to house our prisoners and stay away from any federal intervention.
Are you surprised there's a bit more pushback from your colleagues on the governor going and at it alone? Because when you talk to a lot of these senators and members of the House, they'll tell you, well, I mean, there are so many obstacles and there's economic reasons that we could never get this done because people don't want prisons taken out of their district because they're such big economic drivers. I mean, you hear we tried this before. But it doesn't seem, at least not to me, that it seems to be like there's a lot of just, okay, we're okay with Governor Ivey doing this on her own, whereas I would think the legislature would want more of a say in a lot of what's going on here just because of the dollars amount involved and, like you said, the potential cost savings if you just bonded it out rather than doing it through this lease agreement. You would save the taxpayer money. But is it just because it's such a political heavy lift that you're not really hearing much pushback?
You know, that might be the case. I didn't run for office to not have to make tough decisions. I mean, I welcome those tough decisions. That's why the people of my district elected me, and that's what I'm here to do. I think shying away from that once you've been elected is really the wrong answer. But I would say to anybody that's not willing to take this on, you know, we have a responsibility to the taxpayers to make sure that we run this government as efficiently as possible. And mark my words right now, Jeff, we're going to run into a situation where the governor's projections on the costs, annual costs of these leases, are going to fast outpace what they say they're going to be able to fund them with, and that is the savings on maintenance. And this is going to end up costing a whole lot more money. And most of the legislature and this governor will be gone by the time those chickens come home to roost. And it's going to be left to the taxpayers to fund a inefficient and expensive plan.
So you're just to clarify, you're skeptical of the idea that we could just by merely upgrading and updating facilities that there would be cost savings enough that will cover the expenses for this plan.
I think there is no way in the world that passes the smell test and that anybody believes that that's really going to happen.
Senator, we got to leave it there. We're out of time. Hey, I appreciate this. I'm glad you're going to be doing this every week. I'm really looking forward to it.
Glad to have you here. Thanks.
All right. That's State Senator Chris Elliott here on the program. Try to get with him every Friday. Get caught up on what's going on. We got to take a timeout. We will return. This is FM Talk 106.5. Stage and a beautiful babe to squeeze my life in my simple way. Guess you could say I'm living in the big time. Mount Cheehaw is my Everest, and the Coosa is my now. Alabama's where I was born and raised, and I think I'll stay a while. We sing about sweet home and Dixieland delight. We tell stories about what goes on in Montgomery at midnight. Welcome back to the Jeff Poor Show on FM Talk 106.5. This last 5 minutes of the first week, we have made it this far. Thank you for sticking with me. It means a whole lot. I really, really appreciate that. Also, thanks to Sean Sullivan for giving me this opportunity behind a microphone. It went fairly well. Just a few hiccups along the way, I think.
Could have been a lot worse.
I mean, I know you're like, man.
Could have been a lot worse.
But the regret there, yeah, it's starting to go away now. You're starting to feel
there's
a bit
not
better
been
about
regret, man. I pursued you on this, and I'm happy you're here. Happy. Now I'll say this. It's a little more competitive now on show guest than before. A little more challenge there on the show guest, but I'm happy. I'm happy you're here. Your show's here. Of course, what it does is brings together 8 hours of live local talk here every weekday, which is exciting. And having your guest list is incredible. Your takes on things. I mean, this is the man that I would call and say, I kind of think it works this way, but does it? And Jeff would always be the person there for me to help me figure it out. So
the
I'm
best
excited.
Part is sometimes he calls, and then I will talk to him for like 20 minutes and then like, what am I doing, man? Are you still there?
I'm listening. I'm taking notes. So no, I appreciate it.
Yeah. So you know, like when there is an explanation, it gets a little long winded at times. I feel like we did that a little bit of that yesterday. I was like, well, here's what you got to look for, Sean. You know.
Well, and that's good. You know, we're trying to navigate a lot of things on national politics and also here statewide. Can you imagine the level? I know there's always intrigue when they're not in session, but you imagine the conversation level, and we pay attention to it, you know, here on this station, where it does not get covered in print very well, does get covered online with Yellowhammer and all that, but the attention we pay to Montgomery, there's a reason we do it, y'all. It's not just we want to talk about Montgomery. I mean, that's, you know,
I tell you, it's fascinating. It's so compelling the way Montgomery operates. It's so much different than Congress. And but it's hard to understand. But when you start seeing how these different parts of the state all work together for something, it's amazing. It's
or work apart from each other.
Well, work apart a lot of times, for sure. All right, guys. Well, thank you for joining us today. Well, stay tuned for Midday Mobile with the aforementioned Sean Sullivan. This has been the Jeff Porsche Show on FM Talk 106.5. Cowboy.